I gurgle for breath. Cagney replaces Karnas, sitting on my chest, knees pinning down my arms. I suck down air. She smiles in my face and looks at my hairline, lips parted with excitement of dominating another person. She twists my hair into her grip. Her hot breath smells like spearmint.
"What have we here?"
she asks, pulling my datapad from its place in my arm.
"Damn it. He hailed the Augustans. I'd rather not fight that Julii bitch without my armor."
"Then stop dawdling," Karnas growls. "Do it."
"Shh," she whispers, as I try to speak, tracing a knife over my lips, pushing it into my mouth till the brittle metal clacks against my teeth. "That's a good little bitch." Roughly, she saws off my hair. "Nice and quiet. Good, Reaper. Good." Blood stings my eyes as Karnas shoves Cagney off my chest, grabs me, and hoists me off the ground with his left hand. He flexes his right arm, cursing about his ruined bicep. He can't pull it back to swing a punch, so instead he grins toothily at me and headbutts me once in the chest, just at the sternum. My world rocks. There's a crackle, the sound of twigs over a fire. I wheeze out bubbling, inhuman sounds. Karnas headbutts me again and tosses my aching body to the ground. I feel warmth splash over me, and the smell of piss claw into my nostrils. They laugh, and Karnas breathes into my ear.
"Mother bid me to tell you, a pauper can never be a prince. Every time you look in the mirror, remember what we did to you. Remember you breathe because we let you. Remember your heart will one day be on our table. Rise so high, in mud you lie."
Chapter 4. Fallen. I stand before my master, but he does not care. The office walls are of panelled wood, and on the floor lies an ancient rug his iron ancestor took from a palace of earth after the fall of the Indian Empire, one of the last great nations to stand against gold. What dread those natural-born humans must have felt to see the conquerors falling from the sky, man perfected, but bringing chains instead of hope. I stand in front of Augustus's desk, a bare thing of wood and iron, just before the 700-year-old bloodstain where the final Indian emperor had his head parted from his body by a sleek gold killer. Idly, Nero Au Augustus strokes the lion that lies beside his desk. They look like twin statues. Behind them is space. A viewport peers into the blackness, where the ships of the Scepter Armada lie like giant golems in terrible slumber. We pass them on the last leg of our 3-week voyage from Mars. Augustus peers at his desk as a stream of data runs over the wood. It seems so long ago that he took me on a tour of Mars to show me our domains, from the Latfundias where high reds toil over crops, to the great polar reaches where obsidians live in medieval isolation. He favored me then, bringing me close, teaching me the things his father taught him. I was his favorite, second only to Leto. Now he is a stranger, and I an embarrassment. It's been 2 months since the day Karnas beat me at the academy. Though my hair has grown back and my broken bones have mended, my reputation has not. And because of that, my tenure in Arch-Governor Augustus's employ is tenuous, at best. My enemies grow by the day, but these new ones prefer whispers to razors. More and more do I believe the sons of Ares chose the wrong man. I am not made for the cold war of politics. Not made for subtlety. Hell, I'd hide a boy in the gut of a horse any day, but I wouldn't know how to bribe someone properly if my life depended on it. A gentle, warm voice, made for half-truths, drifts through the arch-governor's office. Three refineries, two nightclubs, and two grey police outposts. All bombed since we left Mars. 7 attacks, my liege. 59 gold fatalities.
Pliny.
Slender as a salamander, with skin as smooth as a pink's. The Politico is no peerless scard, never even went to the Institute. His glittering eyes peer out from eyelashes that would put peacock plumage to shame. Muted lipstick coats thin lips. His hair is coiled and scented. His body thin but muscular, in a pleasing but utterly facile way, beneath a too tight embroidered silk tunic. A child could beat the living hell out of this beautiful kitten of a man. Yet he's ended families with a rumour here, a joke there. His power is of a different breed. Where I am kinetic energy, he is potential. I've heard he's also responsible for ruining my reputation. Tactus even hinted that Pliny might have put Carnus up to the violence in the garden, or, at the very least, arranged a holocam to record my proud moment. Beside Pliny stands the fourth man in the room, Leto. He's a bright lancer 10 years my senior, with braided hair and a half-moon grin. He's also a poet with the razor, a younger Lorne Al Arcos, according to some. It's likely he'll inherit Augustus's estate instead of the arch-governor's blood heirs, Mustang and the Jackal. Truth be told, I rather like the man.
The sons of Ares grow too bold.
Augustus mutters.
Yes, my liege.
Pliny squints.
If it is indeed they who perpetrate the act.
What other ant bites us?
None that we know of, but there are spiders, ticks, rats in the world.
The bombings are crude for Ares, indiscriminate, uncharacteristically violent, discontiguous from the pattern of technological sabotage and propaganda in his profile. Ares is not capricious, so I struggle believing these acts originate from him.
Augustus frowns.
Then what do you suggest?
Perhaps there is another terrorist group, my liege. With 18 billion souls on the census, I hardly think one man has a monopoly on terrorism. Perhaps even a criminal syndicate. I've been creating a database I can share.
Pliny is right. The terror attacks that have plagued Mars and other planets make little sense.
Dancer spoke of justice, not revenge. These attacks are petty and gruesome. The bombing of barracks, fashion outlets, bazaars, high-colour coffee shops and restaurants. Ares would never condone them. They draw too many eyes for too little result, daring the gulls to act, to crush the suns.
I've sent messages to Dancer via the holobox.
Nothing. Just silence.
Could he be dead? Or has Ares abandoned me for this new strategy of bombing?
Pliny yawns.
Perhaps Ares has changed his tactics. He's a deuced one.
If Ares is a man, Leto says.
Interesting. Augustus swivels abruptly. What makes you think Ares isn't a man?
Why do we assume Ares is a man? He could be a woman. Could be a group of individuals, for all we know, which would go a long way toward explaining the discordant nature of these new attacks.
Leto turns to me, eyes inclusive.
Darrow, what do you think?
Don't befuddle Darrow with complex questions.
Pliny crows defensively.
Make it a yes or no, so he can understand.
Pliny flashes me the most pitying of smiles and squeezes my shoulder in sympathy.
Behind his leopard smiles, he's an honest, simple beast. You should know that. I stand there and take it.
He turns away.
In any manner, Leto, you're forgetting we designed Red Culture to be highly patriarchal. Their identity as a people centers around the collection of resources to propagate the embryonic terraforming of Mars. Physically strenuous, grueling tasks performed by men. Tasks we don't let their women perform, even if they are capable, pursuant to the stratification protocol. So, you see, it can't be a woman, because no roughneck ruster would follow a man or woman who has never ridden a claw drill.
Leto smiles cleverly. If Ares is a red.
Pliny and Augustus both laugh.
Maybe he's a deranged violet who's taking his acting to a new stage,
Pliny offers.
Or a copper cambist beleaguered by filing provincial tax returns,
Leto adds.
No, an obsidian who, dare I say, has finally forsaken his terror of technology and developed the skills to use a holo camera.
Pliny slaps his leg.
I'd give away one of my roses just to see... My godman, enough!
Augustus cuts him off, tapping his finger on the desk.
Pliny and Leto share a grin and turn back to Augustus.
Your recommendation, Pliny?
Of course.
Pliny clears his throat. Unlike their propaganda and cyber-attacks, the brutality is quite simple to counter. Ares or not, issue a reply. Our kill teams are prepared for tactical strikes on several terrorist training grounds beneath Mars's surface. We should strike now. If we wait, I fear the Sovereign's Praetorians will take matters into their own hands. Loonborn don't understand Mars. They'll slag it up.
A fool pulls the leaves. A brute chops the trunk. A sage digs the roots.
Augustus pauses.
Something Lorne Au Arcos once said to my father. It's engraved on the Hall of Blades in New Thebes. Striking training grounds will do nothing except fill the holonet with pretty explosions. I tire of political plays. Our strategy must change. With every bombing, the Sovereign grows wearier of my administration.
You govern Mars,
Leto says. Not Venus or Earth. Ours is not a placid planet. What does she expect?
Results.
What do you have in mind, my liege?
Pliny asks.
I intend to poison the sons of Ares' roots. I want suicide bombers, not greys. Find the ugliest, nastiest reds on Mars, hold their families hostage, and threaten to kill their sons and daughters if the fathers do not do as we command. Focus the suicide bombers on surface areas with high youth density, as well as two choice mines. No women bombers. I want social divide. Women against violence.
How little life costs here. Just words in the air.
Urban areas, too,
he continues.
Not just browns and red miners and agriculturists. I want dead blue and green children in schools or arcades next to Sons of Ares glyphs. Then we'll see if other colors still sing that girl's gory damn song.
My heart dips a beat. Io's song spread further than she dreamed, reaching the holonet and ripping across the solar system, shared over a billion times thanks to anarchist hacker groups. Time and again, I fear I'll be recognized. Perhaps some gold will search through the records to find that Io's husband's name was also Darrow. But even I hardly recognized that skeletal, pale boy. And as for names, there are no true records for low-red names. I had a number designation given to me by some officious copper administrator, L17L6363, and L17L6363 was hanged from his neck until dead, whereupon his body was stolen by an unknown perpetrator and presumably buried in the deep mines.
You plan to alienate red from the other colors, then alienate the suns from red,
Pliny smiles. My liege, sometimes I wonder why you even need me.
Do not patronize me, Pliny. It's beneath the both of us.
Pliny bows. Indeed, apologies, my liege.
Augustus looks back to Leto.
You're squirming like a pup.
I worry this will make matters worse.
Leto frowns to himself.
Presently the sons are a nuisance, yes, but hardly our chief plight. If we do this, we could be pouring fuel on the flames, and worse, we'd be as guilty as the sons themselves. Terrorists.
There's no guilt. Pliny peers idly at a stream of data on his datapad. Not when you're the judge.
Leto isn't satisfied.
My liege, our imperative to rule exists because we are fit to best guide mankind. We are Plato's philosopher kings. Our cause is order. We provide stability. The sons are anarchists. Their cause is chaos. We should use that as our weapon, not greys in the night, bombers among children.
We should aspire to a higher purpose?
Pliny asks.
Yes. Perhaps fashion a media campaign against the sons. Dara, wouldn't you agree?
Again, I do not answer. Not until the arch-governor acknowledges my presence. He does not value impudence or impropriety unless it benefits him.
Idealism.
Pliny sighs. Admirable in the young, if misguided.
Take care in talking down to me, Politico.
Leto growls, scanning Pliny's smirking face for the absent peerless scar.
Your plan should be less brutal, Arch-Governor. That is my point.
Brutality.
Augustus lets the word hang in the air.
It is neither evil nor good. It is simply an adjective of a thing, an action in this case. What you must pass is the nature of the action. Is it evil or good to stop terrorists who bomb innocents?
Good, I suppose.
Then what do our methods matter, so long as we harm fewer innocents than they would harm if we continue to allow them to exist?
Augustus folds his long-fingered hands. But, at the core, this is no philosophical issue. It is a political one. The sons of Ares are not the threat. Not at all. All they are is a weapon for our political enemies, namely the Bellona, to use as an excuse to claim I cannot control Mars. The curly hairs already seek to strip me of the governorship. As you know, the sovereign has sole power to remove me from the position, even without a vote from the Senate. If she wishes, she can give Mars to another house. Bellona, our allies the Julii, even a non-Martian house. None of these entities would run Mars as effectively as I. And when Mars is run effectively, all benefit, low and high. I am not a despot. But a father must cuff the ears of his children if they make an attempt to set fire to his house. If I must kill a few thousand for the greater good, for helium free to flow, and for the citizens of this planet to continue to live in a world untorn by war, then I will. Which brings us to Darrow Au Andromedus. Now his cold eyes turn on me. Fresh from ordering the deaths of 1,000 innocents, and I cannot help but flinch as a dark hate rises inside me. I bow my head in polite deference.
My liege, you summoned me?
I did, and your purpose here shall be brief. You were a gambit when I took you from the Institute and put you in my employ.
You know this?
Yes.
I thought your merit to be sufficient. I found your rivalry with Cassius Al Bellona amusing, in a schoolyard way. But the blood feud declared between you has become, he spares a glance at Pliny, burdensome to my interests,
both economically and politically. Substantial revenues have been lost due to tariff increases to the core, where Bellona supporters lie. Houses waver in their commitment to honouring deals made years ago at the trade table. So, as an act of reconciliation to these aggrieved parties, I have decided to sell your contract to another house.
I shudder inside.
My liege, I try to interject.
This cannot happen. If he strips me of my place, nearly 3 years of work will have been for nothing.
If I may.
You may not.
He opens a drawer and idly tosses the slab of meat to his lion. The lion waits for Augustus to snap his fingers before eating.
The decision was made a month ago. There is no use bandying words with me. I'm not Quicksilver negotiating the price of lithium futures. Pliny...
The particulars are rather simple, Darrow, so they shall be easy to grasp.
Pliny hasn't taken his eyes from me.
The Arch-Governor has been overly kind in giving you the fair warning in case of termination, as stipulated in your contract.
My contract says I'm to be given 6 months' fair warning.
If you'll recall, Section 8, Subsection C, Clause 4, you're to be given 6 months' fair warning unless you fail to act in a manner befitting a lancer of the esteemed House Augustus.
Is this a joke?
I look to Leto and Augustus.
Do you see us laughing?
Pliny asks primly.
No, not even a scoff or chortle.
Of all the lancers, I came in second at the academy. You couldn't even make it through the institute.
Oh, it's not that. You did well. Enough.
Then what?
It is your constant presence on the HC talk shows.
I've never gone on the HC. I don't even watch it.
Oh, please. You relish your own celebrity. Even though they mock you, you bathe in the limelight and cloak this house with shame. We know your data pad search histories. We see you preening at yourself on the HC as though it were your personal mirror. The stories run on you and the Arch-Governor's daughter.
Mustang is in court on Luna,
which you likely encouraged. Did you ask her to join the Sovereign's Court? Is it part of your plan to divide daughter from father?
You're spinning horseshit, Pliny.
And you create a tawdry name for Augustus. You brawl with Bellona in baths set aside for refreshment and contemplation. This we cannot abide.
I don't even know what to say. He's making it up. There's enough in reality to make a case, but he lies just to spit in my eye, just to show that I am in his power.
Pliny continues. The termination of the contract will occur in 3 days.
3 days,
I echo.
Till then, you will accompany us to the surface of Luna and stay in the residence provided for the House Augustus for the summit, though, as of this moment, you are no longer a lancer of this house. You do not represent the Arch-Governor, and may not use his name to gain access to facilities nor curry favour with young ladies or young men, neither in boast, promise, or threat. Your house datapad will be confiscated, your Lancer ID codes have already been downgraded, and you will cease and desist participation in all projects to which you were previously assigned.
I have only been assigned construction projects.
Pliny's lips crawl into a reptilian smile.
Then this shall be an easy transition.
To whom am I being sold?
I manage.
Augustus doesn't look in my eyes as he abandons me.
He pets his lion. You would guess I'm not even in the room.
Leto stares at the ground, ashamed. He's nobler than this charade. But Augustus wants him here to watch, to learn how to amputate a rotten limb.
You are not being sold, Darrow. Despite your birth, I would have expected you to understand your place.
We are not pinks or obsidians to be sold as slaves. You're
services are being traded at auction.
Pliny says.
It's the same gory thing, I hiss. You're abandoning me. Whoever buys my services cannot protect me from the Bellona. Those curly-haired bastards will hunt me down and kill me. The only reason they didn't 2 months ago was because...
Because you were an Augustan representative? Pliny asks. But the arch-governor does not owe you anything, Darrow. Is that the misapprehension you suffer? In fact, you owe him. Protecting you costs us money. It costs us opportunities, contracts, trade. And that cost has proven too dear. We must be seen to promote peace with the Bellona. The sovereign wants peace. You, you're a source of friction, a chafing bar in our proverbial saddle, and an instrument of war. So now we melt our sword into a plowshare.
But not before you use it to lop off my head.
Darrow, do not beg.
Pliny sighs. Show some resolve, young man. Your time here has expired, yes, but you've got pluck. You've got the vigour of a young man. Now, straighten that spine of yours and leave with the dignity of a gold who knows he tried his best.
His eyes laugh at me. That means leave this office.
Now, my goodman, before Leto throws you out on your preposterously toned buttocks.
I stare at the arch-governor. Is this what you take me for? Some snivelling child to be pushed into a corner?
Darrow, it'd be best if... Leto begins.
It is you who have pushed us into a corner, Pliny answers, putting a hand on my shoulder.
If you're worried you won't receive a severance package, you will. Enough money to...
The last time one of the arch-governor's lackeys touched me, I buried a knife in his cerebellum 6 times.
I look at his hand as he quickly withdraws it. I square my shoulders.
I do not answer to a scarless pixie whelp. I am a peerless scard, arch-primus of the 542nd class of the Institute of Mars. I answer to the arch-governor alone.
I take a step toward Augustus, causing Leto to take a protective angle. The length of my temper is well remembered.
You put Julian Au Bellona in the passage with me, my liege.
My eyes burn down at him.
I killed him there for you. I warred against Carnus for you. I kept my mouth, the mouths of my men, sealed after you tried to buy your son victory at the Institute.
Leto flinches at that.
I altered the recordings. I proved myself better than your blood heirs. Now, my liege, you say I'm a liability.
You are a peerless scard.
The arch-governor agrees, examining data on his desk.
But you are of little substance. Your family is dead. They left you with no lands, no holdings of resources or industry, no position in government. All was seized as their debts came due, including their honour.
What scraps you have been given by your betters, cherish. What favour you carried, remember.
I thought you favoured deeds, not titles. My liege, Mustang has left you. Do not make the mistake of severing me from you as well.
Finally, he raises his head to look at me. Eyes belonging to some creature beyond man, a distant, callous calculation fueled by monstrous, inhuman pride. A pride that goes beyond him and stretches back to man's first feeble steps into black space.
It is the pride of a dozen generations of fathers and grandfathers and sisters and brothers, all distilled now into a single, brilliant, perfect vessel that bears no failure, abides no flaws.
My enemies embarrassed you. So they embarrassed me, Darrow. You told me you would win, but then you lost. And that changes everything.
Chapter 5. Abandoned.
I will soon die.
That is the thought I carry with me as our shuttle coasts away from Augustus's flagship and flits through the Scepter Armada. I sit among the Lancers, but I am not one of them. They know. Appropriately, they do not speak to me. Whatever bond they could make does not matter. I have no political capital. I overhear Tactus being offered a wager to see how long I'll last outside of Augustus's protection. One Lancer says 3 days. Tactus argues ferociously against the number, showing the true extent of the loyalty I earned from him at the Institute.
10 days, he declares. At least 10 days.
It was he who launched the escape pod without me. I always knew his friendship was conditional. Yet still, the wound gnaws deep, carving in me a loneliness I can't express. A loneliness I've always felt among these goals, but tricked myself into forgetting. I am not one of them. So I sit there in silence, staring out the window as we pass the gathered fleet and wait for Luna to appear. My contract ends on the final evening of the summit, where all ruling families gather on Luna to deal with matters pressing and frivolous. That is the 3-day window I have to improve my stock, to make others think that I am undervalued by the Arch-Governor and ripe for recruitment. But no matter my value, I am marred. Someone had me, then threw me away. Who would want such a used thing? This is my fate. Despite my golden face and talents, I am a commodity. It makes me want to tear my bloody damn sigils out. If I'm to be a slave, I should at least look a slave. To make matters worse, there's a price on my head. Not officially, of course. That is illegal, because I am not an enemy of the state. Yet my enemy is far worse. Far crueler than any government. She is the woman who sent Carnus and Cagney to the Academy. They say every night since I stole Julian's life in the passage, his mother, Julia Au Bellona, has sat at the long table of her family's high hall up on the slopes of Olympus Mons, and lifted the semicircular lid of the silver tray brought to her by the pink manservants. Every night, the tray remains empty. And every night she sighs in sadness, peering down the table at her large family, only to repeat the same vindictive words.
It is clear I am unloved. If I were loved, there would be a heart here to sate my hunger for vengeance. If I were loved, my boy's murderer would no longer draw breath. If I were loved, my family would honor their brother. But I am not. He is not. They do not. What have I done to deserve such a hateful family?
Then the grand Bellona family will watch their matriarch uncoil from her chair, her body withering from hunger, nursing instead on hate and vengeance. And they will remain silent as she leaves the room, more wraith than woman. What has kept my heart from her place is the Arch-Governor's arms, money, and name. Politics, the very thing I hate, has kept the breath in me. But in 3 days, that aegis will be a shadow of memory, and all that will protect me are the lessons my teachers have given me.
It'll be a duel, one of the Lancers says.
Then louder,
can't turn that down and keep his honor for long. Not if Cassius himself offers it.
Old Reaper has a few tricks up his sleeve, Tactus says. You might not have been there, but he didn't kill Apollo with his smile.
Used a razor, didn't you, Darrow?
Another Lancer asks, tone mocking.
Haven't seen you on the fencing grounds of late.
You've never seen him there, says another.
The pixie avoids what he's not good at, eh?
Roke stirs angrily beside me. I put a hand on his forearm and turn slowly to regard the offending lancer. Victor sits behind him, idly watching the scene. I don't fence, I say.
Don't or can't?
Someone asks with a laugh.
Leave him be. Razor masters are expensive,
Tactus notes with a sly grin. Is that how it is, Tactus? I ask. He makes a face.
Oh, come now. Just having a go at you. So gory damn serious. You used to be more playful.
Roke says something to make Tactus scowl and turn away, but I don't hear. I've sunken into memory, where this golden game once seemed so easy. What has changed? Mustang.
You're more than this,
she whispered, as I left her for the academy. Tears swelled in her eyes, though her voice did not waver.
You don't have to be a killer. You don't have to court war.
What other choice do I have? I asked.
Me. I'm the other choice. Stay for me. Stay for what might be. At the Institute, you made followers of boys and girls who have never known loyalty. If you go to the Academy, you abandon that to be my father's warlord. That's not what you are. That's not the man I...
She did not turn, but her face changed as her sentence trailed away, lips drawing a hard line.
Love? Was that what we built in the year after the Institute?
If so, the word stuck in her throat because she knew, as I knew, that I had not given her all of me. I had not shared all that I am. Greedily, I kept secrets.
And how could someone like her, someone with so much self-worth, bare herself and throw her heart at a man who gave so little in return?
So she closed her golden eyes, shoved the razor into my hands, and told me to go. I don't fault her. She chose politics, governance, peace, which is what she thinks her people need. I chose the blade because it is what my people need. It fills me with a strange emptiness knowing that I was enough for her when I was never enough for Io. Roke was right. I pushed her away. I didn't push Severo away. I asked him to be stationed with me, then suddenly he was reassigned to Pluto, like many of the Howlers, relegated to protecting far construction operations from petty pirate raids. I now suspect Pliny's hand in that.
My path has never felt lonelier.
You'll not be abandoned, Roke says, leaning in close. Other families will want you for themselves. Don't let Tactus in your head. The Bologna won't make a move against you. Of course they won't. I lie. He can still sense my fear.
Violence isn't allowed in the Citadel, Darrow. Especially blood feuds. Even duels are outlawed unless consent is given by the Sovereign herself. Simply stay on Citadel grounds till you've a new house and all will be well. Bide your time. Do what you must. And in a year, the Arch-Governor will feel like a fool when you've risen under the tutelage of another. There is more than one path to the top. Always remember that, brother.
He grips my shoulder.
You know, I would ask my mother and father to bid for you, but they won't go against Augustus.
I know. They could spend the millions on the contract and not even notice the loss. But Roke's mother has not sat a senator for 20 years because of her charity. Her lot is thrown in with Augustus's contingent in the Senate. What he wills, she supports. I'll be fine.
You're right. I say, as Luna appears in the window, hushing the aides, and filling me with dread. The city moon of Earth, orbiting satellites and installations encircle it like a steel angel's halo wrapped around a ball of amber held to the sun. I'll be fine. Chapter 6 Icarus. We land near the citadel. Sticky, polluted wind bends the towering trees near our landing pad. Perspiration quickly beads along the top of my high collar. Already I do not like this ugly place. Despite the fact that we land here on citadel grounds, which are far from the nearest cities and surrounded by forests and lakes, Luna's air cloys and sticks to the lungs. On the horizon, just past the spiked spires of the citadel's western campus, Earth hovers, swollen and blue, reminding me that I am so far from home. The gravity here is less than Mars's, only 1/6 Earth's, and it makes me feel unsettled and clumsy. I seem to float when I walk, and even though coordination quickly returns, my body suffers its own lightness with strange feelings of claustrophobia. Another vessel lands to the north.
"Looks like Bellona Silver," Roke says quietly, squinting against the sunset. I chuckle.
He glances back at me.
"What?"
"Just imagining having a pulse rocket right about now."
"Well, that's just lovely of you."
He walks along. I follow, eyes lingering on the vessel.
"I do love the sunsets of Luna, like we're in Homer's world. Sky a hot shade of fresh-forged bronze."
Above, the alien sky melts into the night with the long setting of the sun. For 2 weeks, the daylight will disappear from this part of the moon. 2 weeks of night. Luxury yachts cruise through this strange day's end, while nimble, blue-piloted rip-wings roar past on patrol, like bats glued together from shattered ebony. The 1/6 gravity lets these loon-born build to their heart's desire, and build they do. Beyond the citadel grounds, the horizon is fenced with towers and cityscape. Rung paths wind everywhere so that citizens can pull themselves through the air with ease. The network of rungs stretch between high towers, as would ivy, linking the heavens with the hells of the low districts. Along them, thousands of men and women crawl like ants on vines, while grey patrol skiffs buzz around the thoroughfares. The household of Augustus is assigned a villa nestled within 30 acres of pines on citadel grounds. It's a pretty thing among other pretty things in this stately place. There are gardens, paths, fountains carved with little winged boys of stone, all that sort of frivolity.
"Fancy a session of cravat?" I ask Roke, nodding to the training facility beside the villa. My mind's running away with itself.
"I can't,"
Roke winces, stepping out of the way of our fellow lancers and their attendants who file into the villa. "I have to attend the conference on capitalism and the governed age."
"If you wanted a nap, I'm sure they have beds in the villa."
"You joking?"
"Regulus Agsoon is giving the keynote."
I whistle.
"Quicksilver himself.
So you're going to learn how to make diamonds out of gravel. You hear the rumor about him owning the contracts of 2 Olympic knights?"
"It's not a rumor, at least according to Mother. Reminds me of what Augustus said to the sovereign at her coronation. A man is never too young to kill, never too wise, never too strong, but he can damn well be too rich."
"Arco said that."
"No, I'm sure it was Augustus."
I shake my head. "Check your facts, brother. Lorn au Arco said it. And the sovereign turned to reply, 'You forget, Rage Knight, I am a woman.'"
Arcos is as much myth as man, at least to my generation, reclusive now. He was the Sword of Mars and the Rage Knight for over 60 years. Peerless knights across the society have offered him the deeds to moons if he would but tutor them for a week in his form of cravat, the Willow Way. It was he who sent me the knife ring that killed Apollo and then offered me a place in his house. I rejected it then, choosing Augustus over the old man.
"You forget I am a woman,"
Roke repeats. He cherishes these stories of their empire, the way I cherished stories of the Reaper and the Veil.
"When I get back, let's talk, not the usual banter."
"You mean you won't yammer on about a childhood crush, drink too much wine, wax poetic about the shape of Quinn's smile, and the beauty of Etruscan gravesites before falling asleep?" I ask. His cheeks flush, but he puts a hand over his heart.
"On my honour."
"Then bring a bottle of foolishly expensive wine and we can talk."
"I'll bring 3. I watch him leave, eyes colder than my smile.
Several of the other lancers attend the conference with Roke. The rest make themselves comfortable as Augustus's grey security teams comb the grounds. Obsidian bodyguards trail goals like shadows. Pinks sway gracefully into the villa in a constant stream, ordered from the Citadel's garden by members of the Arch-Governor's household staff, who find themselves bored from travel and seek a little merriment. A pink Citadel steward guides me to my room. I laugh when I arrive. "Perhaps there has been a mistake," I say, looking around the small room with its adjoining washroom and closet. "I'm not a broom."
"I don't under..." "He's not a broom, so he won't fit in this closet," Theodora says, standing in the doorway behind us. "It is beneath his station."
She looks around, pert nose sniffing disdainfully. "These would not even suit as closet to my clothes on Mars."
"This is the Citadel, not Mars."
The steward's pink eyes survey the lines on Theodora's aged face. "There is less room for useless things." Theodora smiles sweetly and gestures to the rose quartz tree pinned to the man's breast.
"I say, is that the black poplar of Garden Dryope?"
"Your first time seeing it, I would guess," he says haughtily before turning to me. "I don't know how they raised your pinks in Mars's gardens, Dominus, but on Luna your slave should do her best to look less affected."
"Of course. How rude of me,"
Theodora apologizes. "I merely thought you would know Matron Carena." The steward pauses.
"Matron Carena? We were girls together in the gardens. Tell her Theodora says hello and would call on her if time is found."
"You're a rose." His face goes sheet white.
"Was. All petals wilt. Oh, but do tell me your name. I would so like to commend you to her for your hospitality."
He mumbles something quite inaudible and departs, bowing lower to Theodora than to me. "Was that fun?" I ask.
"Always nice to flex a little muscle, even if everything else is starting to droop."
"Seems my career ends where yours began." I chuckle morbidly and walk over to the holo display sitting near the bed.
"I wouldn't," she says.
I bite my bottom lip, our signal for spying devices.
"Well, of course, that. But the holonet is not where you want to be right now."
"What are they saying about me?"
"They're wondering where you'll be buried."
I haven't time to reply before knuckles rap against the frame of my room's doorway.
"Dominus, Lady Julia requests your presence."
I follow Victoris Pink to her room's private terrace. Her bath alone is larger than my bed.
"It's not fair,"
a voice says from behind the ivory-white trunk of a lavender tree. I turn to see Victra playing with the thorns of a shrub. You being cut loose like a grey mercenary?
Since when have you been concerned with what's fair, Victra?
Must you always fence with me? She asks. Come, sit.
Even with the scars that distinguish her from her sister, her long form and luminous face is without true fault. She sits smoking some designer burner that smells like a sunset over a logged forest. She's heavier of bone than Antonia, taller, and seems to have been melted into being, like a spearhead cooling into angular shape. Her eyes flash with annoyance.
I'm as far from an enemy as you have, Darrow.
So what are you? A friend?
A man in your position could use friends, no?
I'd rather have a dozen stained bodyguards.
Who has the money for that?
She laughs. I raise an eyebrow.
You do? Well, they couldn't protect you from yourself.
I'm a bit more worried about Bologna razors.
Worry? Is that what I saw on your face as we descended?
She lets a merry sigh escape her lips.
Curious. See, I thought it was dread. Terror. All the truly unsettling things. Because you know this moon will be your grave.
I thought we weren't fencing any more. I say,
you're right. It's just I find you very odd. Or at least I find your choice in friends to be odd.
She is sitting in front of me, on the lip of the fountain. Her heels scrape against the aged stone.
You've always kept me at arm's length while bringing Tactus and Rogue close.
I understand Rogue, even if he is as soft as butter.
But Tactus? It's like flossing with a viper and expecting not to get bitten. Is it because he was your man at the Institute that you think he's your friend?
Friend? I laugh at the idea. After Tactus told me how his brothers broke his favorite violin when he was a boy, I had Theodora spend half my bank account on a Stradivarius violin from Quicksilver's auction house. Tactus didn't thank me. It was as if I'd handed him a stone.
He asked what it was for.
I said, for you to play.
He asked why.
Because we're friends.
He looked back down at it and walked away.
2 weeks later, I discovered he took it and sold it and used the money for pinks and drugs. He is not my friend.
He is what his brothers made him to be, she notes, hesitating as if reluctant to share her information with me. When do you think he's ever received something without someone wanting something in return?
You made him feel uncomfortable. Why do you think I'm wary with you? I lean closer. It's because you always want something, Victra. Just like your sister.
Ah, I thought it might be Antonia. She is always ruining things. Ever since the she-wolf gnawed her way out of mother's womb and stole human clothes. Good that I was born first, else she might have strangled me in my crib. And she's only my half-sister, anyway. Different fathers. Mother never saw much point in monogamy. You know, Antonia even goes by Severus instead of Julii just to take a piss on Mother. Cantankerous brat. And I get saddled with her moral baggage. Ridiculous.
Victra plays with the many jade rings on her fingers. I find them odd, contrasting with the Spartan severity of her scarred face. But Victra has always been a woman of contrasts. Why are you talking with me, Victra? I can't do anything for you. I have no station, I have no command, I have no money, and I have no reputation. All the things you value.
Oh, I value other things too, darling.
But you do have a reputation, all right. Pliny's made sure of that. So he did play a part in the gossip. Thought Tactus was just running his mouth.
A part? Darrow, he's been at war with you since the moment you kneeled to Augustus.
She laughs.
Before then, even.
He counseled Augustus to kill you then and there, or at least try you for the murder of Apollo. Didn't you know?
She shakes her head at my blank stare.
The fact that you're just now realizing this shows just how ill-equipped you are to play his game. And because of that, you're going to be killed. That's why I'm speaking with you. I'd rather you found an alternative instead of sulking in your beastly quarters. Otherwise, Cassius Aubelone is going to come and he's going to take a knife and dig it right here.
She caresses my chest with a long nailed finger, etching the outline of my heart. And give his mother her first real meal in years.
Then what is your suggestion?
You stop being such a little bitch.
She smiles up at me and holds out a data slip. Grudgingly, I take the edge of the thin metal slip, but she holds on, pulling me towards the edge of the fountain, between her legs. Her lips part, her tongue playing along the top, as her eyes trace my face, up and up to my eyes, where they try to spark a fire. But there's none there. With a feline sigh, she lets the data slip go. I run it over my personal data pad, and an advertisement for a tavern appears on my display. This isn't on Citadel grounds, I say.
So?
So, if I leave, it's open season on my head.
Then don't advertise your leaving.
I take a step back. How much are they paying you?
You think this is a setup?
Is it?
No.
How do I know you're telling the truth?
Most people can't afford the truth. I can.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. You never lie.
I am of the gens Julii. She stands slowly, anger uncoiling like a razor. My family trades in commerce enough to buy continents. Who could afford to purchase my honor? If one day I become your enemy, I will tell you, and I will tell you why.
Everyone's honest till they're caught in a lie.
Her laugh is husky, and makes me feel small and boyish, reminding me she's 7 years older than I. Then stay, Reaper. Trust in chance. Trust in friends. Hide here till someone buys your contract, and pray they didn't do it just to serve you up to the Bellona like a suckling pig.
I weigh the odds, and extend a hand to help her up.
Well, when you put it that way.
Colonel Valentin?
Victor asks, the shorter of the two greys who wait for us on the ramp of the shuttle. It's a shit can, one of the ugliest flyers I've ever seen. Like the front half of a hammerhead shark. I eye the taller of the greys warily.
Yes, Domina.
Valentin says, nodding his cinder-block head with the rigid precision of a man risen through the ranks.
You are sure you were not followed?
Certain as death, Victor says.
We should depart fast-like, then.
I follow Victor into the shuttle, scanning the grounds behind us. We wore ghost cloaks as soon as we departed Augustus's villa. A dozen hidden hallways and six old grav lifts later, we arrive in a dusty, seldom-used section of the Citadel's launch pads. Theodora left us there. She wanted to come, but I won't take her where we're going. A grey scans Victor and me for bugs as we board the ship. The ship's ramp slides closed behind us. 12 craggy greys fill the small passenger hold of the shuttle. They're not the dashing sort, just craftsmen of a dark trade. Though there are averages, colours are diverse in composition due to human genetics and the differing ecosystems throughout the society. The greys of Venus are often darker and more compact than those of Mars, but families move and mix and breed. The talent levels in each colour are even more variable than appearance. Most greys aren't destined for anything more than patrolling shopping centres and city streets. Some go to the armies, some